This is the way it feels to move through summer in Lululemon. Iconic align softness without the front seam. For our smoothest look and feel ever, summer won't know what hit it. Stretch your limits in the non-stop flexibility of the new Lululemon Align No Line Pant in select stores and at lululemon.com.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail, companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop. And hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest on my podcast this week is Niklas Hanitsch, co-founder and CEO of Secure.
Bootstrapping was definitely, I think, something that made us successful because we had time to really focus on the business and not focus on fundraising, on creating reports and stuff like this. So we learned a lot about what customers really want in that time because we could spend all our time with customers.
This is Niklas. He's a tech entrepreneur on a mission. He was an idealist punk who turned lawyer and then SaaS founder. He's got a deep expertise for data privacy, compliance, and agile product development. In November 2023, he made it into the prestigious Top 40 Under 40 list by Capital Magazine. Over the years, he grew the belief that while data protection and compliance requirements are important, the implementation should not be a stumbling block for companies. And that became the big idea behind Secure, an AI-driven compliance automation platform, which he founded in December 2017. And their vision? A world where businesses are always compliant, but never have to think about it. And that inspired me, and hence I invited Niklas to my podcast. We explore how personal tragedy grew into entrepreneurial drive. He shares how he bootstrapped the company towards growth, navigated fundraising during a recession, and built a resilient team culture from the start. Beyond that, he elaborates on his frameworks for strategic decision-making, hiring for values fit, and relentlessly delivering customer value. And last but not least, he shares practical advice on how to stay motivated and sane in the crazy world of building a software business. And by listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, how bootstrapping gave him an advantage that you cannot get when you start your venture with VC backing. Secondly, his approach to staying ahead of the competition as the markets get more crowded. Thirdly, his advice, having been a lawyer himself, on how to go about committing to contracts. And lastly, his three-step framework for hiring talent. Well, hi, Niklas. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Hi, Ton. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a little story for everybody that's listening here. I was recently an MC at the South Summit, and that's where I introduced Niklas to the stage, where he was interviewed by someone else. And I got impressed with the story behind the company Secure. So the only thing I had to do was, just to invite you for a separate session and do it as a podcast episode.
Yeah, I'm happily accepted.
So, before we start talking about your company Secure and how it all got started, a little bit about you. What drives you? What gives you energy as an entrepreneur?
I think entrepreneurship itself gives me a lot of energy. I had some jobs before I founded this company before, and I was always searching for meaning in life. And I think entrepreneurship was what gave me that meaning.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, I read a couple of things about you, and one thing was, you know, talking about that meaning in life wasn't a super like the usual thing that people think about. Can you tell me a little bit more about it? I mean, yeah, I read something about when you were 12 years old, a family member committed suicide, yeah. And that was transformative for how you started.
Yeah, that's correct. So when I was 12 years old, my mother or my stepdad, my mother's then partner, committed suicide, and I had a very deep relationship with him. And after that, I was sent to boarding school because my dad was in hustler mode back then. So he was always working, and my mom had to deal with her own suffering, and she couldn't really deal with me back then. So I was sent to boarding school, and I felt super, super alone, and had to, somehow process my emotions on my own. And I think this was when I learned to look out for myself. And I think this somehow paved the way to becoming self-employed later and an entrepreneur. Yeah, that's a tough start for a podcast. And
exactly. Well, I mean, but it is so relevant because it proves again that, I mean, there is an opportunity for everybody out there. Even if you're in the biggest shit almost that you can possibly think of, there is opportunity in it. You can learn something from it to take your whole thing to a level that you couldn't even imagine before. So that's what I find fascinating about it. And of course, the story in itself is horrible, and I wish nobody should have that. So yeah, you started your company in 2017, December, it says on LinkedIn. What was the problem that you saw back then that was screaming for a solution?
Yeah. So I can give you a little bit more background to why I started this company, and then I get to the point of what problem we're solving. So when I was in high school, I used to be a punk, and I used to be like anti-establishment and anti-capitalism and pro everything, animal rights, socialism, and so on. And then, I was maybe 15 back then, but then at some point life happened and I became the opposite of a punk, which is a lawyer. And as a lawyer, I'm still a political person, and I still want to change the world for the better somehow. And that's how I got more into the public law space, the public legal space. And because I'm also a nerd, and I've always been a nerd, I landed in more like the digital regulation space. And once I graduated from law school and passed the bar exam, I started working for Amazon, the legal department. And there I was also working, that was back in 2017, and I was confronted with a lot of GDPR issues. And I knew a little bit how to code, and I saw that a lot of the processes that I had to do were super, super repetitive. And I thought, hey, this could be automated, and people shouldn't be paying lawyers like a shit ton of money to do that all over again. And I just saw an opportunity for founding a company to automate GDPR processes. And that's how we started Secure back in 2017. And then we launched actually in 2018 when the GDPR got into effect.
Yeah, exactly. Compliance, once complex, now simple, it says on your website. I mean, you cannot make it clearer than that. Intriguing, by the way, as well. So I understand the problem, and it's fascinating how your life turns around when it comes down to like, okay, what do you want to become when you grow up almost? So first punk, then compliance missionary, starting the business coming from the problems that you saw from Amazon. I can't even remember anymore like when the whole GDPR movement started, but I think it was around that time.
Yeah, it was in May 18. Yeah, May 18.
Exactly. Yeah, that's true. I just started my own company as well, and I had to start dealing with that. I can, of course, imagine that there's many companies out there that that jumped on that wave. What has been an early decision in how you started the business that appears to be really important for what the success is right now?
I think it was not really a conscious decision. It was more we tried to figure it out, but bootstrapping was definitely, I think, something that made us successful because we had time to really focus on the business and not focus on fundraising, on creating reports and stuff like this. So we learned a lot about what customers really want in that time because we could spend all our time with customers.
Yeah, exactly. So you said bootstrapping. So you created your first product, a product that solved a meaningful problem for customers. The complex part about GDPR.
Yeah, basically, and, we looked at what the data protection officer has to do, and then we chose first the low-hanging fruits, what can be automated. And of course, we didn't build everything from scratch. We used some already existing technology, like learning management systems and stuff like this. And for example, a data protection officer needs to train the employees of a company about what they should and should not do with regards to GDPR compliance. And then I recorded videos myself and uploaded them to a learning management system. And that was one puzzle piece of our product back then.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly also what I was pointing at with my question, because there's, of course, a lot of things to choose from. You can decide to kind of build it all by yourself, or you make choices. What do you build and what do you buy or partner for? What was the part where you just said, okay, this is what we have to do ourselves. This is the build part to differentiate ourselves.
Again, we were not so super strategic back then. We were just fighting one day to survive the next day. Yeah. But we knew that everything customer data related should be in our hands. So the data infrastructure, the logins and so on. So all this part that is customer facing should be more built than bought.
Exactly. Well, that's a fundamental piece of the whole, actually backing up your name as well, Secure.
Yeah.
So what has been the hardest nut to crack on that journey?
Hardest not to crack, probably maintaining a healthy culture in the team, because you will startup is a roller coaster ride, and I've been doing this for more than 6 years, almost 6.5 years now, and there are ups and downs, and some of them, I mean, it's my first company, right? So of course I made a lot of mistakes, and some of them led to some catastrophes, and this, of course, the team sometimes doesn't take so well, or when you really fuck up, you also might have to lay off people because you grow too fast or you burn too fast or whatever. And maintaining a healthy culture, that's probably for me the hardest part.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that, of course, that I hear a lot in all the interviews that I do. This culture is the foundation of the business at the end. If you have the right people, then a lot of things become a lot easier. I wouldn't say easier. Take me through that journey of 2017, end of 2017, you start the business. Then, of course, you start working with the low-hanging fruit, like you just said. Then COVID comes along. Did it have any impact on your business?
Not really. Because we always were a remote first company. I mean, we have an office, but we hired talent from where we could get it. So developers from Ukraine or we were very remote, and even before COVID, so we didn't have to change anything about it. If anything, then we kind of benefited a little bit from COVID, because all the other companies that were not as digitized as we were already were sending all their workers to the home office, and then they had to ensure data privacy and security and so on. So I wouldn't say it made such a huge impact, but if it had any, then was a positive impact to our business.
Exactly. So you, I mean, what I read is that at some point you decided to stop the kind of the bootstrap journey and to start funding.
Yeah.
And what I learned from you is that you started fundraising during the recession, which I think came after COVID. What did you learn from that? And why did you choose to go fundraising in the first place?
Yeah. So mainly, I mean, why do you fundraise? Because it opens some doors, like investors can open some doors that you might not be able to open yourself. But of course, money injection also can help go to market and product. And if all your competitors are choosing that road, they have more money to spend on marketing and on product. So they might outpace you at some point. Their product might become way better than yours, or they can even burn money and to acquire customers in an unprofitable way just for like growth at all costs. And so they can even outbid you with that money. So at some point in a very competitive market, I think everyone might be forced to go fundraise at some point.
You did this when the recession kicked in, which is sort of counterintuitive.
I think we've started fundraising before the recession kicked in, and we kind of just slid through before like it hit rock bottom. Right. So we were basically still the lucky ones, but of course, this is also now some time ago, and we also needed to secure some bridge funding in the meantime, and that was not the most pleasant experience.
Okay, I can imagine, yeah, exactly. What did you learn from it? If you would do it again, what would you do different?
Again, first time being in the position to be able to spend all the money, you can easily get carried away and want too much at the same time, and then you can get confused and lose focus. So I would try to really focus on what brings the most value to the business, and it's necessary to experiment, but I wouldn't experiment as much and not too much, and I would just like what is working best right now, and then use the money to double down on that. And yes, maybe have two or three smaller gambles on the side that can bring or can create value in the future. But I wouldn't overstress that.
That's it's a common answer, but it's a tough one to do at the end. Because at the when you got the money in the bank and you have the opportunities to kind of try all these things, you don't see the negative side of it, and it can like you say, it can be really burning money. So it can feel like that. Do you have a framework for making decisions? A framework that helps you in preventing the wrong decisions to make.
I just had a thought that I wanted to add to the last answer, if I may.
Sure.
For the fundraising part, I just had one additional idea. So I thought about what is important for successful fundraising, especially during a recession. And I hear a lot of founders always stressing out about the perfect pitch. And in the end, I believe that the pitch is by far not the most important part of it. I think even our pitch sucked and we still were able to raise 5.5 million seed round with it. I think the most important part is obviously the market, then the team, and then also if you are able to create some FOMO, and for that you need to build up relationship with investors and do some back channeling and stuff like this, and be very strategic about what you say to whom and what you may also not say to a certain person, because then they start thinking and they start like getting into it and making up their own minds. And I think that makes for a successful fundraise during a recession. And that I just wanted to add that.
Well, great addition. And I don't think it's only during a recession and these things are critical in the first place. And it's in fundraising, but it's even in dealing with customers and possibly beyond that. You know, there needs to be, the market needs to have a particular value that is going to create, whether this is for an investor or for a customer. The team, of course, is the trust that you're going to deliver on that. And the FOMO is whether there's an urgency. Because, I mean, sometimes these things are nice to have, but there needs to be something that is making it critical. And these things together. I mean, I'm actually referring here to my book. I think it's page 24. I'm talking about a triangle to make decisions. And it's about, like what are the problems you solve? And then for each problem, identify on a scale of 1 to 10, how valuable it is, how critical it is, and whether you can actually exceed expectations on it. And the place here as well. And once people see that, you don't even need a pitch because it's clear.
Yeah, that's
so right. It's exactly. Well, thanks for adding that. Going back to my question that was follow on there, do you follow a framework?
We do follow frameworks. First, we have some management frameworks, like we use OKRs. Yeah. We plan them for, we are agile, but we plan the OKRs for 1 year ahead at the beginning of the year. And then we conduct workshops with, if the team size is not so large, with the whole team, and because that gets buy-in for the company strategy. But then what is more important, even in my opinion, we do regular risk metrics workshops with also at least the management team, where we as a team look at what are the current risks, and many of these risks are related to each other, or some, and especially some of the mitigation strategies for these risks. They might mitigate two or more risks at the same time, and we just put a matrix on the screen on a Miro board, and then everyone prepares in advance, adds the current risks that we see, and of course some of them are ongoing. And then we look at them together in a workshop, and then we move the risk on the framework with how likely is it to materialize, and how bad would it be if it materializes, and then what can we do about this in another chart. And then this helps us to decide on all types of decisions, either product related or go to market related, and operationally related. And this again gets a lot of buy-in from the team for unpopular decisions, because you only have a limited amount of resources, and in each sprint you can only do that amount of user stories. And one team might want that feature so badly, but then the other one wants that feature. And if you just in the group talk about it, why are we prioritizing this right now? Because currently, for example, our product is really good for building up an ISMS, but for managing an ISMS, we still have some room for improvement. One big reason would be product-related customer churn at the moment. So we prioritize features that are good for managing the ISMS in order to prevent future customer churn, for example. That's how we get to prioritizing short-term strategy items.
Let me make a small interruption here. Niklas just made an excellent remark about their approach to making better decisions through risk metric workshops. Instead of looking at risk in isolation, they address them as a team. That not only helps them to make the right decisions, but also creates alignment and buy-in, especially when it concerns the more complex and unpopular decisions. It's a trait remarkable software companies master. They focus on the essence by looking at each decision from various perspectives. It makes them more resourceful and resilient as a business. And that's competitive advantage. And you can master these traits as well. The first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview. Cool. Do you only prioritize around risk, or do you also prioritize around opportunity?
Yes, we do that, but that's more in the OKR workshops.
Yeah, okay. Understand that. Yeah, exactly. Fascinating. Yeah, that's a good one. What I like about your approach is that it puts things in perspective, because otherwise everything looks the same.
Yeah.
And also what I like about it is that you do it with the whole team, simply for everybody to understand, okay, yeah, I thought I'm a big proponent of this. This is my agenda, but actually that one is more important. And therefore, I'll give up on it, or my turn will come later on. So it's
actually one of my team members, my head of product, came up with that approach. But I've been criticized in the past a lot for not being the best communicator in the company and not being 100% transparent, even though I'm like, honesty is super important for me, and there's nothing I want to hide from anyone or so, if I'm not legally obliged to do so. But yeah, still, it's been tough to always keep everyone updated on everything that's going on and why did we decide this and that. And I think implementing this has really helped in getting a lot more transparency to the whole team, and I think everyone likes it.
Exactly, because now it's all put in context, and certain things might, yeah, you might decide on it on a day-to-day basis based on gut feel or based on what you just think is the right thing to do, but now you have a story around it and people can connect the dots themselves. I like that. And in preparing this, you were talking about a framework that's about talent, experience, and value fit.
Yeah. That's for hiring, and that refers to, like, I believe keeping a healthy culture is first the most crucial, and second also the hardest part of running a business or running a successful business. And I copied this framework. Obviously, it's not, I didn't invent it, but I found it super useful. I think people can either be super experienced or inexperienced, and that's both fine. Like, you can hire juniors, they will become experienced at some point, yeah. But if they're motivated, then everything's great. They can be either super talented or not so talented in some aspects, but then in others more talented, which is also fine. So they can either have like a big T or a small T, but the only thing that they should not have is a small V, which stands for value fit. And that's basically a no hire, an automatic no hire decision then.
Because yeah. So how do you determine no value fit?
I mean, we have some company values laid out, and I think we live them every day, and we just conduct a set of interviews with a lot of different people, and then these people meet and discuss, do you think this person fits our values or not?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, of course, you could translate value into different things, but this is the value of the company values. How do you operate? How do you work? What do you do? What do you stand for? These type of things, rather than the monetary value of things.
Yeah. No, of course.
I understand that.
And then there's another, like, I always try to explain the world in simple terms to myself. And I believe there are different types of personalities. And of course, it's not a zero-sum game. It's like there's always like a broad range. But still, I believe that there are people who fall more into like the nerdy category. What do I mean by that? They dive very deep into topics and they're brilliant, but they might not be so good in presenting these things. I would say I tend a little bit more into that category. Then there are, I call them the sellers, who are like, who might get bored if they need to dive too deep into the matter, but they are super good in presenting and selling these ideas to whomever and like getting people on fire. And I think a company needs a healthy balance of these two characteristics.
Exactly.
And then there's the third category, which is the people who actually don't really care so much. And this is the only category that you need to keep out of your company culture.
Yeah, the care part is a really important part. Exactly, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've also made some mistakes in the past when I was looking at my own team, and I had a fantastic team. But one of these exercises indeed revealed why we had certain challenges in the team, because I think it was the insight framework where you have red for decisiveness and yellow for creativity and green for helpers and blue for structure. And our whole team was red, yellow, and green, and there was no blue at all. That's an interesting thing. I also had the CEO of the company called GC Index on my podcast, I think 2 years ago or so. And that's also a pretty interesting framework. It looks at five different categories. And again, you can really understand who you are yourself, where your strengths lie, but typically also what you miss in your team and where you have to kind of find to create that balance, because these things complement each other. Completely agree with you. Talking about the growth of your company, what did it take to get traction, and what made the traction actually at the end sustain at some point to make it more predictable?
So we started in a market that had a very strong market pull.
Yeah,
so exactly. I think we had a easy start. And I think that's maybe also kind of an unfair advantage to a lot of different startups who have great ideas, but maybe the market is not ready for it yet, or maybe it's the wrong time, or maybe the idea is not so good sometimes too. But I think finding a market or finding something that people actually want or need is like the most important part. And so finding a blue ocean market, basically, but that at some point when a lot of people realize that this ocean is very blue, other sharks will come and try to eat all the fish, and then they will turn the ocean red.
Exactly.
And then basically what we always do is we try to find the next blue ocean. So at some point, when we started with GDPR, it was like we couldn't take as much customers as we got leads. But this curve flattened a little bit. I mean, it's still like a massively growing market, but now we're fighting with a lot more competitors who also want to service these customers. So what we decided to become a more holistic, modular compliance automation tool. So we don't only do GDPR, we just do different frameworks like information security, AML, supply chain, and so on. And yeah, I think there will always be a blue ocean. And in order to keep the traction first, of course, you need to be sure that you're still delivering value to your customers in your bread and butter business. But then again, you also need to find blue oceans to continue expanding.
Exactly. Very good point. Do you then make those decisions in terms of growing your existing customer base with something else? Or is it that you'd really start targeting a different type of customer? How do you make decisions on that?
No, I mean, of course, we are a VC-funded startup, so we need to track all different types of metrics like NDR and so on and so on. And we have a customer success team who's in charge of up and cross-selling existing customers. And we have revenue goals that need to come from revenue expansion and so on. So yes, of course, we do both.
Yeah, exactly. So the primary thing is to be more valuable to your existing customer base. Connecting it to kind of a framework of my book, or at least a trait of my book. My book is about the 10 traits that define the software companies that we start talking about and keep talking about, the remarkable software businesses. And one of the traits is trait number 6, is that remarkable software businesses don't just have customers, but they turn as many customers as possible into fans. Do you follow a similar type of framework? How far do you go in order for a customer to stay forever?
I mean, basically, we just try to constantly deliver as much value to the customer as possible. And we are talking to them and we are asking them if we're still delivering value. And of course, also we are the compliance experts, so we need to know what they need to do in order to stay compliant, because getting compliant is one thing, but then you also need to stay compliant. So we also proactively offering them new features, new solutions. We try to stay state of the art in new tech. We try to implement every new technology there is that is helpful and serves some purpose, or can help make the product experience better or less stressful. So
exactly. As there's a follow-on question there, you build your products, there's a blue ocean. At some point in time, the ocean starts to create more competitors, it starts to turn red, and you find your adjacent areas to add more value to customers. What do you then optimize for? I mean, is your company, because it's VC funded, is profitability already a metric for you that is super high on the agenda? Or do you kind of prioritize still growing as fast as possible?
No, I think since 2022, there has been a shift in the whole market. So I think everyone is kind of, not growing at all costs anymore. And this also holds true for us.
Exactly.
And I also think it's a healthy development. But then again, I'm also realistic. And I'm pretty sure in 5 years, everything will be forgotten again. And valuations will be crazy and money will be cheap. And so then we'll be back to cash burning for most companies.
Yeah.
But we hope that, we survived this recession and a lot of our customers also went bankrupt. And a lot of I read startup news every morning when I wake up, and I read about so many bankruptcies. And I also know some people who their startups went bankrupt. So I hope that we learned a lot from this, and I'm sure that we learned a lot from this, and that we won't do the same mistakes that almost got us into a turbulent situation at least.
Yeah, exactly. So what have you learned so far? If you reflect on it in hindsight, what has been fundamental for you to survive, maybe even come out stronger from the recession?
The main thing was what I already said first, focus on what works and double down on that and don't get carried away and don't get lost. That's one of the main important things. Then also, you can only trust wet ink and not promises. That's another thing. So, us entrepreneurs, we always see opportunities. And I have very high business values and standards. And everyone can 100% believe in my handshake. But I learned that this doesn't hold true for everyone. And so those things, then read contracts better. I'm a lawyer, but still, I don't memorize every single detail of a 200-page contract. So this might fall back on you in six months or 2 years or whatever. So I think I kind of lost my virginity in this last 2 years, and I kind of grew up in some aspects.
Yeah, exactly. So looking also at the time, if you would give two pieces of advice to aspiring entrepreneurs or people that want to take their business also to a next level of growth, what would be a do and what would be a don't that you'd like to share based on what you know right now?
Yeah, a do, I think, so my main strength is that I can do a lot of pain, and I never give up, and I always try to find ways around and to get back on my feet and keep going and keep moving. And I think you don't need to be the smartest person in the room. You don't even need to be the toughest person in the room. Actually, sometimes it can even be a problem to be the toughest person in the room, because the toughest person in the room is oftentimes not the most sympathetic person. And I think sometimes you might win a small battle, but you will lose the war in the end, because people want to work with people they like and not with assholes. So it's not about being the smartest or the toughest or whatever, but it's about never giving up. And I think this is a do. But still, you need to be tough, of course. You still need to be fucking tough, but that's not all of it. And a don't is don't fuck yourself over. So I always tried to make it right for everyone else. And I always, I never prioritized my own health, my own well-being, my own free time, my own salary or whatever. And I always lived for the future and lived to build and so on. And at some point, yeah, I mean, it might fall back on you. I mean, this it's a gamble, right? And this might work out, but you might also be wasting a lot of years of your life if it doesn't work out, and then you have wasted your health and your maybe your family and you and so on. So a do is take some time for yourself, find something that you like, and it can be like the little things. Right now, for example, I'm getting a motorcycle license because then at least I can drive to the office in the morning and I will have half an hour of fun. And on driving a motorcycle, you cannot look on your phone. And if I'm in the car at every stoplight, I check my emails and so on. So driving a motorcycle can be a meditation for you, even if it's just for commuting to the office and then coming back at night. So find something that you enjoy and try to have some, at least some pleasure in every day. And I think that this can make a big difference.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a very wise advice. Otherwise, the grit will also be super hard. You know, no one can just go through those pains and the grit and the and standing up and falling down again. You need, there needs to be something that is coming your way as well in terms of fun or energy that you get from it. Yeah. I think also where how we started the podcast. Your focus on the mission is coming in place, because if you don't believe in the pain and you don't believe in the mission of solving that, grit will also be very, very tough for you. Well, thank you very much for sharing all of this. Good luck on the next steps on the journey. Where can people go to find out more about Secure or to say hi to you?
Thank you for having me. And yeah, thank you for everyone who has listened to us. And happy to connect with you on LinkedIn or wherever.
Okay. And the website is secure.com?
www.secure.com.
Perfect. Okay, good. I'll put it into the show notes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And this ends my conversation with Niklas. And I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning in to this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Niklas Hanich, founder and CEO of Secure. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.